Hello, and welcome to this first Tim Blackmore interview of 2014. Welcome also to my guest, a man who's been a significant player in the UK's national radio landscape for more than four decades, and whose literally golden tones have graced the leading stations of both the commercial and public service sectors. He is, of course, Simon Bates. Simon, you won't remember it, but the first time I was ever interviewed on radio, you were asking the questions.
That was about the story of pop, wasn't it?
It was 1973.
And it was in the evening, round about 10 o'clock, on a show called Late Night Extra.
Correct. Now, was Radio 2 your first employer in the UK?
No, Radio 4.
And what was that as?
The world's worst newsreader. I could change presidents into kings and thousands into millions at the drop of a hat.
You're particularly well known for having one of the most distinctive radio voices in the country. And when we both started out, a good voice was a prerequisite. I'm just wondering whether you think that voice quality is still relevant in today's radio market?
Voice quality is an interesting one, because does that mean tonality and does that mean also comprehensibility? I don't think it matters. And in fact, I'm not sure I agree with you. You'll remember a broadcaster called John Dunn, who didn't have a very good voice, but what he did with what he had was miraculous. So I'm not sure I'd agree with you. I think the thinnest voices make people work a little harder, and probably that results in something special.
When you said what John Dunn had was something miraculous, is it worth attempting to try and define what you think that quality was?
I think he worked twice as hard because he knew he didn't have, quote, a great instrument to work with, and therefore the pausation was considered, every word that he said was considered, and the way he said it. I can't put it more than that because, of course, he was very senior to me and I wouldn't have dared to say, that's a bit of a fluty voice you got there, mate. If you listen to him now, of course, it sounds like the Ark, because it was the 1970s and a different world. I think it's what you did with the voice. Bob Harris. I don't know where Bob's voice is, but somewhere around his ankles. And it works. If it works on radio and if you have management clever enough to observe that and to recognise it, then it adds to the joy of nations.
You made reference to, it was a long time ago, the 1970s. So given that it is, you know, four decades or so, has your style of broadcasting, of presentation, changed? Or are you still doing it the same way you did then?
That's a bugger of a question, Tim. I don't know, because I don't examine myself too carefully, because if you do, you become more and more aware of the pitfalls into which you fall every day. I don't think my voice has changed much, or my accent. It was the accent I was born with. I guess if you listen to radio as much as we do, and you hear people do clever things, good things, you think, God, I wish I could do that. I wish I'd thought of that. Then probably you plagiarise self-consciously or semi-consciously.
Do you see yourself as a personality broadcaster?
No, never have. Jobbing broadcaster.
What's the difference between a jobbing broadcaster and an announcer?
What do you want me to do? You, Tim Blackmore, employ me. For 50 quid a week, as what? Do you want me to read the news? I'll do that for you. Do you want me to ad lib? I'll try and do that for you. Do you want me to read a script? I'll try and do that for you. That's, in other words, I'm the generation that says, direct me, tell me what you would like, and I will try and do it.
So we would be hiring your voice rather than your personality?
If on the contract it said £50 a week, personality broadcaster, I would assume then you wanted all singing, all dancing. And if it said serious voice, I'll do that as well.
If you were a chef, I suppose your signature dish would be Our Tune. Now, that's a format that you've used on more than one station, and it's one that's proved hugely successful and hugely entertaining. What would you say, looking at that particular area of your broadcasting, were the qualities that you needed to find in a story in order for it to work within Our Tune?
God, I've never been asked that question, and it's a good one. It was designed originally as I met him at a disco, he was lovely, we got married and lived happily ever after, by a guy called Ron Belcher, who you knew. And Ron, to say the least, was volatile. And after lunch was unspeakable. But he had some great ideas, and he came from that well of talent that the BBC had. What he didn't realise and what I didn't realise was that the listener at that time would latch onto it and expand it themselves. They became the progenitor of what it expanded into. I think the trick with it, if there ever was a trick, was to read the letter and to read between the lines. If you could do that, and I've been very lucky with producers and very lucky, Claire Sturgis, people like that, who had a natural empathy. If you have an empathy with someone who takes the time to write to you, to email you, and you can read between the lines of what they're saying, then you've got it.
And that presumably would need you to extrapolate beyond just reading between the lines and actually put some words out that were yours rather than the listener's.
That's always been the case, and I would put it to you that that's probably because I'm no good at reading scripts.
Well, if I'm going to analyse your technique, which clearly I am about to do, I'd say that the music you're introducing, whether it's our tune or whatever, is not the most important element in what you're doing. You're one of those broadcasters who, to me, seems to want to create a mood, who wants to make maybe a sales pitch that hopefully the listener can't resist. I mean, is that fair, that you were more going for creating a mood rather than enthusing about the music?
It's entirely unfair, and it's always been wrong. The music is the most important element of anything that I do. If you get the music wrong, then there's no point in doing it. I've always been a music fan. What I've never done and never want to do is to boast about my fandom, is to in some way place myself above people who know better than I do, who would say, I don't know, Robert Plant and I, that syndrome. What I have always done is regard the music as being the most important prop, because you can do a great piece, but if you go into There's No One Quite Like Grandma, you're going to come a cropper, aren't you?
Is there a difference of technique between presenting music that matters on Radio 1, as it was, and Classic FM, say?
I mean, no.
Tell me what the difference is.
There is no difference. It's fascinating. When Roger Lewis, who now, of course, runs Wales, when he said, come and do a programme on Classic FM, the first thing I said was, look, I love Tchaikovsky and Mozart, but that's it. I don't know anything about classical music. And he eyed me sourly and said, you can look it up. Which, of course, is the truth about broadcasting. You can look it up. You can learn. You can talk to people. I loved my time at Classic FM. I learned a huge amount. And with that goes enthusiasm. And I think that communicates to an audience. If you are holier than thou, if you sit back and say, well, dear audience, I know more than you do about this, the audience will get irritated.
And now you're back with mainstream pop music. I mean, is that different yet again?
Yes, but the same treatment. What's different? It's difficult for me to put my finger on it, but what's different between Haydn and the Motown School, to pick a label that you know more about than I do? What's different? Give me that one, Tim.
Well, the notes are the same. It's what you do with them, isn't it?
And different order, as paraphrased somebody. It's about music. It's about enthusiasm. It's about love, because music is the most, and it can be the human voice as well. Think of Dylan Thomas, and you think of that resonant voice in 1953 that got you, even though the microphone wasn't very good, when, what's his name, did Undermilt Wood. It's music.
So music clearly important to you in all sorts of genres. Have you been happier when you've been just presenting music, or when you've done those programmes where it's involved interaction with people and interviewing and that kind of conversation thing?
I don't think I'm a very good interviewer, and I was a lousy phone-in host, a really, really bad one, because I didn't know how to edit live. And I don't think I've ever quite got that one right. There are a great many very, very clever phone-in hosts, Clive Bull, people like that. James O'Brien is one. And they can take you on a journey which I don't think I can do.
The biggest station, as I understand it at the moment in the UK, is Radio 2 overall. it maintains the idea of personality presenters, but even on that station, it's changed. If you look back at the 40 years, what would be the changes that you have noticed in the way that people present music radio?
Okay. Now, no names, no pack drill, okay? Being off mic seems to be an art now. Not tuning a microphone properly seems to be an art. And very often, great broadcasters confronted by three other people in the studio lose the plot. Is that fair? As a view, I mean.
Yeah, some people would say that's a bit, perhaps a little cynical.
I know, because I can think of one brilliant broadcaster who's not on daily, who I love listening to, but the moment somebody else starts giggling, that person loses interest in me.
Well, you may interpret...
But I sound like funny, don't
I? I could interpret what you're saying as something that I have some concerns about, and that is the extent to which the so-called teams, the broadcasting teams, the broadcasting partnerships, can sometimes fail to work for that very reason that I think you're highlighting, that that is the point at which I feel they're having a good time, but I'm not included in it. And that can be a disappointment. I mean, quite clearly, some partnerships work extremely well, but there seem to me there are too many on the radio which are there because somebody thinks it's a good idea, not because it actually brings the listener in.
It also doesn't allow some people to show their mettle and to show how good they are. By hiding behind that, they very often don't actually demonstrate how good they are. I agree with the implication totally of what you say. I also think that good partnerships are made in heaven, not in a contract office.
What advice would you give, you know, if you were drafted in to address some course at a college or university, right, even, and they say, you know, I'd like to get on in radio, I'd actually like to be behind a microphone. What advice would you want to give to such young people who were aspirant broadcasters?
That's a difficult one, because giving advice is not something I willingly do, mainly because I had it so easy. I started in America, went on to New Zealand, went on to Australia at a time when you could do anything. And management was, I think, gratefully turned up and maybe slightly surprised. Management now is a lot tougher, more professional. If you're talking about an aspirant broadcaster, this sounds really patronizing, but bear with me. Learn about your mic. You know, listen to yourself. See, it's no different to a woman putting makeup on, or a man putting makeup on, for that matter. How do you sound good? How do you make yourself sound good? How does the voice work? Read The Guardian in front of a mirror, because then you'll understand how your mouth works and how you look when you're reading. The fundamental thing is to make your mistakes out of London, because I am cynical about this. Let's be quite honest. If you go to Radio Sausage and do the overnight, you will work yourself out of your own ego and into a professional job, and no one in London will ever hear you. Those are the guys that you want to work for.
OK, thinking about stations, I mean, is there any station from the many that you've worked for that you would pick out as having given you your greatest broadcasting satisfaction?
Satisfaction, wow.
I mean, where more often than not you walk out of the studio thinking, yeah, I did good today.
No, I've never thought that. No. I always go in thinking I'll do good today, and I always walk out with my head a-droop because, you know, you know you can do better, and I never do.
When you hear, as one does quite commonly, disparaging references to the suits in our industry, how do you think about the bosses you've worked for over the years? Once you've gone into the studio and the red light goes on, does it matter who actually signed your contract?
No. But I have a high opinion of a great many people I've worked for, and that would include Beerling. I don't think I ever worked for you, did I? No. I'm adrift here. That would include Beerling and, oddly, his predecessor, who was a very kind man. He was a great one for encouraging people and giving people a liberal dose of support.
And a man who I spoke to on the phone last week, alive and well up in the northeast of England.
I'm delighted to hear it. And, you know, it's difficult. Lewis, Roger Lewis, with whom I fought, who was as difficult as I ever have been, was equally once he settled down a bit and stopped being Rockin' Rog, was a tremendous. It's not being a boss; it's being an aide. You know, and if you have a boss who's an aide, you go in, you do it, and you don't worry about him until afterwards or her.
We talked earlier about the number of people in a studio. Essentially, the presenter's life to me seems to be a lonely one, sitting in the studio, you know, talking to people you can't see. I wonder to what extent that develops the idea of a loner personality. I mean, I just I've always seen you, and I left Radio 1 4 years after, you know, did that interview, so we never actually worked together. But you always struck me, looking at the Radio 1 operation, as being a man who ploughed his own furrow. I never saw you as one of the big team. You always seemed to be, Batesy knows what he's doing. You know, he's on his own. Do you feel that you are able to be a team player, or
no,
are you happy on your own?
I'm not a great team player, if you mean lots of people in the studio having drinks and having a great time. No, that's not me. But I focus well. If you give me a studio and a microphone and tell me roughly what I'm about to do, and a producer I trust, and that's got to be earned, then I'm away. I'm having a great time.
It used to be seen, certainly in those days when I was at Radio 1, that kind of getting into radio was a stepping stone to getting to TV. How often have you thought through those years, maybe I ought to give TV an even bigger go, I ought to push for more TV experience?
What, doing Top of the Pops? I don't think so. No, the money is in radio. The pleasure is in radio, because it's this direct thing that you've got at the moment. You've got a microphone in front of me and a microphone in front of yourself. In television, that door would have burst open and someone would have said, can we do that again? No, I never had any ambition for television. B, I wanted to make a living. And how many 6-episode series can you do in a year unless you're lucky? No, it was always radio. And radio also is more fun, I think.
I totally agree with that. When the Burt Bannister era came in and we witnessed the most spectacular attempts to reduce the size of a radio station's audience, at least that's what it seemed to those of us who were outside. I mean, I can't remember what happened then. Did you jump or were you pushed? What was your situation?
OK, it's fair to say you should feel sorry for Matthew. And I think he thought he was running a Hollywood studio. And this goes back really to Burt. I think Matthew came in, and probably John was quite pleased, for an awful lot of bashing, because it was what John Burt wanted. But maybe Matthew's ego, and you can't be a manager and an egotist. You have to manage things. I jumped before I was pushed. And I think the last thing that Matthew said to me, it was the third time it was said to me, you'll never work in this industry again, which always tickled me. And at the time, it made me laugh, because it was the third time it was said to me. The first time it was said to me, I burst into tears and rushed from the office. The second time and the third time weren't very important.
The demise of radio has been predicted ever since TV began to take a hold back in the 50s. Yet even the very latest Radar figures show a very healthy audience for our medium. We've got something like 90% of the adult population listen to radio during a week, and I think on average for now more than 20 hours a week. Why do you think that video has not managed to kill the radio star?
Blimey. Long question, boring answer coming up. I think because it's about content, and everything is about content, and radio has responded probably quicker than television on content. If you listen to Radio 2, if you listen to Radio 4, it squashes in the most amazing amount of challenging content. Commercial radio inevitably is chasing that and is constricted by the money. And I'm not making an appeal for commercial radio in that either, but it will be inevitable that a well-financed public sector will have better content, brighter content, better news than a small radio station in Reading will have. But I think it's about content, and I think it's not about challenging. It's about assuming that the audience is intelligent, which radio to a great extent does, whatever the station is, and assuming that it wants more. Television was a bit late catching on. In fact, it's still late catching on with that. There's only so many times you can repeat Midsummer Murders and expect a response.
One of the things that seems to me to have happened a lot, particularly over the last decade, has been the extent to which interactivity with the listener has increased. It isn't just a postcard coming in. It isn't just a telephone. It's going faster and faster. And I wonder whether you think it can go even further for an involvement of the listener in terms of maybe helping to create the actual editorial content.
Well, that's fascinating because, yes, I do. I think it's absolutely frightening for me because, of course, what I'm doing is peddling, trying to keep up with what's happening out there. And what's happening out there, you know, we embrace things like Twitter and Facebook, but they're cosmetic. We have not yet got a total interactivity because we even filter phone calls. If I hear Woman's Hour one more time apologise for someone swearing, it drives me crazy when they do that, because why would you have a listener on if the listener doesn't get to express themselves? But I think, and everybody says the internet is the future, I don't think it is nearly as much of a future as a synergy between the listener and the programme maker, which I can't define yet. I think there are elements of public service radio in America where it's starting to work. The ABC in Australia is doing a few things. We're not yet up to date with it because we can't get our heads around it. But I do think exciting is one word, scary is another, that at our peril, we let go of the audience because the audience doesn't think we want to talk to them and listen to them.
OK, we've talked quite a bit about the BBC part of your career, and we're moving towards the end of this brief chat, but I would like to think about commercial radio, because last year UK commercial radio celebrated its 40th anniversary, and I wonder what your perspective would be on the way in which commercial radio has grown and developed across those 40 years.
Blimey, become more professional is the simple answer, and become more collective in its responsibility. Commercial radio, which does labour, I think, under huge difficulties with very old-fashioned legislation from Ofcom, in which, you know, I always remember John Simon said to me that initially, in the early days when he was running a radio station, to qualify as a blues artist, you had to be black, because that was Ofcom's perception of what, you know, Eric Clapton shouldn't be. I think there should be less restriction on commercial radio. The restriction up to now has been in many ways very healthy, but the BBC quite properly is grabbing hold of every opportunity. Commercial radio still is hamstrung, I think, by what it is, what is viewed as a genre of music, and I'm very nervous of genres, because that usually means you're packed into a crate and shipped off to South America. I think if maybe commercial radio was given a little more responsibility for governing itself, it would now prove to be a very rewarding medium.
You're working with Smooth at the moment.
Yes, I am.
Do any of these limitations impact on your current broadcasting role, or does the regulation not impinge on you at all?
It doesn't impinge on me directly, but I'm aware it impinges on programmers. I think there is a problem, certainly for Global, in that it has to think very tight boxes all the way around. And I'm not sure that's the right and healthy way for them forced to be. Now, if you know, they own the radio station, so if they want it to play Al McCogan non-stop, yeah, fine, away you go, because they're paying for it. But the reality is, I don't think they perhaps feel, what's the word I want, freedom, which the BBC does have. Listen to Chris Evans in the morning, and the variety of stuff, and the very carefully, not presented, but very carefully programmed stuff. It's a huge range of material. You couldn't get that on a commercial radio station, even if it wanted it.
Because they need to be much more focused than Radio 2 needs to be. I see that. Well, for the last 25 years of his life, as you know, I managed the career of Alan Freeman. And when he invited me to become his manager, about which I knew nothing, I'd never managed anybody in my
really?
Life, he said to me, it's quite easy. He said, there's only one really, really important thing that you will have to do. And I said, what's that, Alan? He said, you will have to tell me when it's time to stop. Now, we have seen all sorts of broadcasters go on well into maturity. I'm thinking of, you know, Alan Keith or David Jacobs or whatever. I mean, do you think there is ever a right time to step back from the mic?
Well, two things to say, and I'll end with an obscenity, because Alan Freeman would have said a particular obscenity to both of us if he was sitting here. First thing is, job offers. If no one offers you a job, that is a gentle hint that maybe it's time to go and plant begonias. People still offer me jobs. Second thing to say, as the great Alan Freeman would have said to both of us, is f***ed a lot of them.
OK. Simon Bates, thank you very much for giving me your time for this interview, and may radio continue to give you huge satisfaction for many years to come. My thanks also to Unique Facilities for hosting this edition. Until the next time, bye-bye.